And good morning, and welcome to this special Martin Luther King Jr. Day broadcast of One Land, Many Voices. I'd like to thank Cecil and Celeste, who won't be here this morning, but hopefully will fill in, and you'll be happy with the substitute this morning. I'm William Seaman. Along with me in the studio is Hala Gores. Good morning, Hala.
Good morning, Will, and good morning to our listeners. This morning, we'll be talking about the devastation in Gaza. We will have with us by telephone in Gaza Al Jazeera correspondent Ayman Muhyildin, who will be joining us in about 15 minutes. If you would like to take part in the conversation with Ayman Muhyildin, you can call us here at 503-231-8187. Please grab a pen or pencil and write this down. You can reach us at 503-231-8187. You will get a chance to ask Ayman Muhyildin questions, and he is in Gaza. We ask that our callers keep their questions for our guest brief so that we can get as many callers in as possible.
On day two of the unilaterally declared ceasefire, Gaza is a land of excavations, as throughout the territory, rescue efforts are underway to dig and sift through the rubble to find those trapped beneath. Reports from the region, however, show a grim picture, as these rescue efforts are almost always not rescue, but recovery of more and more bodies. Bodies of children, bodies of women, bodies of the victims of this 3 weeks of unrelenting war brought to Gaza by the Middle East's most powerful military.
Estimates vary, but the death toll now stands at around 1,300. That's 1,300 killed, including more than 400 children, 100 women, the numbers of civilians ranging up to 80% and higher, at least 5,300 injured, including 1,900 children and 900 women, 100,000 people forced from their homes. On the Israeli side, at least 13 Israelis killed, which include 3 civilians.
Hamas has also declared a ceasefire, along with other factions, including Islamic Jihad, Al-Nidal, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and Al-Seika. If you would like to get plugged in to local efforts on this issue, you can contact Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights through their website at www.auphr.org, or you can call them at 503-287-1885. If you'd like to get to links to humanitarian aid organizations like Oxfam or ANERA, that's the American Near East Relief Agency, or Middle East Children's Alliance, and others, or to national organizations that are working on this issue, such as the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. You can find those links at the PPRC website, that's the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition website, at www.pprc-news.org, where you'll see a link titled 5 Minutes for Action on Gaza. We have about, I would say, 14 minutes before we get to speak with our guest this morning. And so, Hala, I'd like to talk to you. Maybe we could let our listeners know what has been happening locally around this issue. What kind of organizing? I know, for example, that there's a new organization that is formed around the boycott campaign, a boycott targeting Israel, very much in the spirit of the boycott and divestment campaign against apartheid South Africa. What is happening with that campaign here in Portland?
This is a campaign that basically started only about 2 weeks ago. The name of the organization is Oregon's Boycott and Divest from Israel campaign. The focus is going to be mostly local. What we are going to do is study what local companies are selling Israeli products, in particular, products that are built on stolen Palestinian land, companies that are in the territories. And our purpose is to offer those companies an opportunity to do the right thing. We're going to meet with the company officials to see whether they are willing to make the right decision and stop producing products, for instance, in settlements in the West Bank. And if they refuse, and my hunch is that they will not agree to do so, then we will rev up that campaign and focus local energy on putting pressure on those companies to remove their companies out of the West Bank do the right thing. And if they refuse to do so, then we rev it up even further with a writing campaign, with certainly boycotting of their products, maybe having several people out in front of the corporate headquarters of these companies week after week after week, so that their employees know that they are contributing to the horror that is happening in the occupied territories. On a much larger scale, the local community, the peace community, as well as the Arab American community, came together. And in, I believe it was 5 or 6 protests, we really drew the mainstream media's attention, surprisingly, on what is happening in Gaza.
Yes, no, both of us and many hundreds of local Portlanders took part in demonstrations at the federal building. I know Women in Black was at the federal building on Friday at noon. And, of course, the regular Friday rally is focused on Gaza the last several weeks. And then Saturday at 3 p.m. was the last really big demonstration in downtown Portland at Pioneer Courthouse Square. What do you feel is accomplished by these kinds of actions out in the streets?
Well, one of the things that gets accomplished is that we get attention to the cause. Without the local community standing up and saying what is happening in Gaza is a war crime, what is happening in Gaza is not in our name, then the media certainly is not going to focus on the situation in Gaza. And certainly our elected officials are going to continue to ignore us. So a part of what has happened with the local protests is that for the very first time that I can remember, we are getting teenagers involved. We are growing new leaders for peace and justice. And these youngsters at age 14, 15, 16, 18 are full of energy, and they really, their heart's in the right place. And they, for the very first time that I can remember, got involved and started writing letters to Senator-elect Merkley and making phone calls to our elected leaders to demand that the war in Gaza stop.
I want to make sure our listeners know that we are going to be taking calls this morning, as is usually the case here during this time slot on KBOO Community Radio. Please give us a call at 503-231-8187 with your questions for our special guest this morning. Hala, it was very inspiring to see so many people out on the street, so many young people out on the street. And it certainly does seem, those of us who can remember from 2.5 years ago when the Israelis launched a devastating attack in southern Lebanon, and we also have to remind ourselves we're also pounding on Gaza at about the same time, that there are some differences, and there are differences in terms of the response from our elected officials in Washington. For example, Congressman Earl Blumenauer, very early on in this most recent assault by the Israelis in Gaza, called for a ceasefire and engagement. Is that something that's significant, or is this just too little, too late? We have a lot of work to do. Or is this a sign of some progress and some accomplishments?
I believe it's a step in the right direction. I'm not sure it rises to the level of progress. It's a step in the right direction. You know, Congressman Blumenauer took a position that, by Washington, D.C. standards, was courageous. He, without much effort on our side, he on his own went ahead and put this on his website, demanding a ceasefire, calling for Israel to stop, calling for Hamas to stop. That's not something that we have seen in the past. So I was impressed with that. On the other hand, we had hundreds, if not thousands, of phone calls locally orchestrated to Senator Wyden's office. And Wyden ignored us. We know that about 15 peace and justice members of our community here went and tried to meet with Wyden at a Oregon City town hall meeting. And when we all showed up, we were informed that Wyden was not going to be there. He was still in Washington, D.C., and we hadn't been notified prior to that of his trip to D.C., and so we all went there. We're doing more in terms of targeted action, not just having hundreds of people at Pioneer Square, but asking folks to make the phone calls, to write the letters, to keep the pressure, because we believe that things are not going to change from one side or the other, meaning just targeting politicians, or just from the streets of Portland, that things are going to change. It's going to be something that we have to focus on both from grassroots as well as through politicians.
And I want to again remind our listeners that they can call with their questions this morning at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And now we're going to talk a little bit about our guest, a very special guest who was referred to by the Israeli writer and analyst Gideon Levy as my hero of the Gaza War. This is just a remarkable young man who, throughout this most recent assault by the Israeli military in Gaza, has been reporting virtually hourly from the devastation and suffering there. We are currently working to get him on the line, and we'll go to him as soon as we get him. I think maybe I'd like to read a little bit from a local statement, and I have to completely reveal my own part in this. This is a statement by Portland Jews on the crisis in Gaza, and I was one of several people who crafted this statement and circulated it within the Jewish community. So I'll just read a little bit from this statement and urge folks who want to find out more to again visit the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition website, which is pprc-news.org. The statement begins, "As Jews living in the Portland metro area, we call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and an end to the Israeli blockade. We call upon our elected representatives in Washington to take action immediately to bring a ceasefire into effect. From the very beginning of the Israeli assault on Gaza, we have spoken out individually and through American Jewish organizations that have called for a ceasefire and engagement, including Jewish Voice for Peace, American Jews for a Just Peace, Brit Tzedek V'Shalom, and many others. We have been disheartened by the coverage of this issue in our local broadcast and print media, which have all too often commonly showed Jews and Jewish organizations supporting the Israeli assault and Palestinian and Arab and Islamic organizations opposing it. This slanted and misleading presentation serves only to inflame hatred and bigotry in our community. Now, we have just been informed that we do have our guest on the phone, and so Hala will introduce our guest this morning.
Yes, Ayman Muhyildeen is the Gaza correspondent for Al Jazeera English, the international English-speaking news channel of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera network. Raised in Egypt and educated in the U.S., Ayman has worked for several national and international news networks. Since Israel began its war on Gaza, Ayman has been the most reliable, eloquent, and informative journalist on television anywhere. Good morning, Ayman Muhyildeen.
Good morning, or I should say good evening. We're here in Gaza a few hours ahead of you.
Of course. Thank you for joining us on When Land Many Voices.
Ayman, thank you again. Yes, thank you for joining us. Could we start with a description of what it is like today in Gaza? Is humanitarian aid getting in? What are the priorities of the people in these first few days of the ceasefire?
Well, let me first start off by telling you what it's been like for the people of Gaza, and that is for the past 2 days since the ceasefire was declared unilaterally by Israel. The Palestinian people have been going back to their homes, going back to their villages, neighborhoods, and cities in areas that have been completely decimated by the war. And in fact, the scenes that we're seeing have been heart-wrenching, to say the least. There are scenes, people digging through the rubble, trying to recover bodies of loved ones, trying to salvage whatever they can of their homes. We've seen farmland, acres of farmland completely uprooted and people taking their trees, whatever has been left of them, trying to salvage whatever they can of the harvest, particularly olives and orange groves. So it has been a scene that has been very, very emotional for people. We're talking about tens of thousands of people in some communities. And the death toll already, as a result of this, has already gone up by almost 150 people. That's 150 bodies that have been recovered, buried under the rubble that people had not been able to access for several days. So a scene of mixed, very mixed emotions as people find loved ones, but at the same time, a lot of grief as they find out that their homes, villages, have been completely destroyed. In terms of the humanitarian supplies, there is an international humanitarian effort underway in trying to get goods to come in. Obviously, this is at the sole discretion of the Israeli military, though, because at the end of the day, the Israeli military controls all of the checkpoints in Gaza, with the exception of one, which is between Egypt and the southern Gaza border in the city of Rafah. So the Israeli military over the past 22 days of the war now, including the 2 days post-war, has been letting stuff in, but the average daily truckload is somewhere between 70 to 90 trucks. And to put that in perspective for you, the United Nations alone needs about 500 trucks a day to meet its operation. So you can see that 70 to 90 trucks a day being allowed in by the Israeli military is simply not going to really make a difference or really make a dent in the humanitarian crisis here on the ground. People are still being evacuated from Gaza into Egypt for medical treatment, as well as they're being evacuated from Gaza into Israel for treatment. But you're nowhere near the numbers that need to be evacuated. Only about 250 or so may have been evacuated so far. But by some estimates, the number of critical patients out of those 5,000 and above that are wounded is close to 500 or 600. So you can again see how far short that is from what needs to be done. So overall, it's a very grim situation. It's one that is very heart-wrenching, as I was saying, and certainly a very emotional scene for the people as they, now continue to try to rebuild their lives or at least regroup what has happened to them, the traumatic 22 days of this war.
Ayman, living here in the U.S., we've been shielded from much of the horrors of this war. You're familiar with Western and particularly U.S. news reporting on this conflict. What are we missing? What do you think is the most misleading about how this conflict is reported in the Western media?
I think, to be honest with you, it's a twofold problem, particularly when it comes to the Western media. At the end of the day, there's no shortage of images that come out of Gaza. At the end of the day, a lot of international news agencies are operating here. And what I mean by news agencies, to listeners who may not be familiar with it, there are news agencies here who film and document and then transmit their material to clients all around the world, including American clients. And we're talking about Associated Press, Reuters Television, even international ones such as Turkish news agencies. So anyway, they sell their material, whatever they film here, to people or clients around the world, including American networks, CNN, NBC, Fox, etc. The problem at the end of the day, though, is most of these news organizations don't have their personnel on the ground, and most of their personnel is oftentimes flown in for this particular type of coverage where they just kind of parachute it in for a few days, a few hours, and then they're whisked away. The biggest, perhaps, criticism is twofold. One, a lack of contextualization, not being able to contextualize the story and not look at it in a very short-sighted approach. And what I mean by that is this war is not 20 days old. This is a war that has been raging on, particularly in the Middle East, between Israel and the Palestinians for nearly 60 years. And certainly this is the darkest chapter for the Palestinian people in Gaza. In fact, the first day of the strike was the single bloodiest day for Gazans, since the 1967 war when Gaza became under the occupation of the Israeli military. So that's the biggest criticism I have of, Western media, if I can. But more importantly, it's also how in the Western media this conflict is being portrayed. This conflict is not a war between two armies. This is not, two armies of equal or greater strength battling an open battlefield. This is a very highly equipped, well-trained, American-funded war machine on the Israeli side going up against the civilian defenseless population. There's no doubt that on the Palestinian factions, they have military equipment and heavy machine guns and, you know, rocket-propelled grenades, and, you know, they have improvised explosive devices. But when you're talking about what can be described almost as a paramilitary grouping of people going up against what is oftentimes described as one of the most powerful armies in the world, you get a sense of the destruction that was unleashed on the Palestinian population. And that is not my assessment. That is really the assessment of the international organizations that operate here. And really, the statistics speak for themselves. So I think those two important elements are among the most, you know, common criticisms, if you will, that I say the Western media is not portraying or not capturing. And this is what is the biggest disservice at the end of the day for the American audience. And why I think it's so particularly important for an American audience is this. If there's any country in the world that can make an immediate difference and can stop this war or could have stopped this war immediately, it is the United States because of its close relationship with Israel, because of its close relationship and power and influence with so many other countries. But in order for America to make that kind of decision, the public or the general public needs to be well informed, and so too the leaders. And unfortunately, if one was to just base on the media coverage, one can conclude, as many have, that accurate portrayal of the situation on the ground is not being reflected appropriately in the West, particularly in the United States.
I want to mention again to our listeners, we are very fortunate to have from Gaza an eyewitness to the unfolding events in Gaza of the last several weeks, Ayman Mohyeldin, who is a Al Jazeera correspondent. You can ask a question of our guest this morning at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Ayman, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how the Israeli PR people, the spokespersons of the Israeli military, of course, respond to any reports of civilian casualties. It is always the same. I'm sure you're familiar with it. It is that their troops have received fire from a particular region, and they returned the fire. And they, of course, regrettably, there was a loss of civilian life. And so time and time again, we hear that they insist that when a school is bombed or a UN compound or a mosque, that they've responded to fire from militants. Have you, what is, as someone who is on the ground there and is reporting from there, how do you, what is your sense of is there any shred of truth to this sort of response?
Well, there's, to answer it very short and direct, yes, there's no doubt that there is fire coming from places inside Gaza that are densely populated. There's no doubt. The very nature of this war is such that whereby the Palestinian factions, I mean, Gaza is one of the most densely populated areas in the world, so there's no doubt that there are civilians that are being caught up in the middle of the fire. But I want to make this point very importantly, and that is two things. One, the Israeli military, obviously with a very aggressive media and public relations campaign, particularly for this war, they oftentimes will tell you one of two things. One, the Israeli military does not target civilians. And two, the Israeli military uses surgical strikes. That's a phrase that we often hear. But at the end of the day, when you take a look at the incident that killed over 40 people at the United Nations school in Jabalia, and this school was a United Nations school that had been converted into a shelter, a refugee shelter for people trying to flee the fighting. 40 people were killed in that one incident alone. It really undermines the two basic points that the Israeli military is saying, and I say this because the following. One, if it is an accidental error, if it is a technical error that the Israeli military accidentally shot at the school and shelled the school and killed 40 people, then that in itself contradicts the Israeli military assertion that they're using surgical strikes. And that by its definition means that the Israeli military is not engaging in what it's saying it is engaging in, that it's using precise laser-guided and all this fancy technical terminology to describe what it's doing to minimize civilian life. In some ways, it's doing the opposite. It's just shelling open areas, shelling areas, and trying to really exact the civilian population it's, you know, it's brute force. And obviously that could be great cause of concern for people. And the United Nations has said it needs to be investigated for the possible use or possible claims that Israel may have committed war crimes. That's one hand. But if at the same time the Israeli military is targeting an area that is known to the military, which means that the United Nations school has, the United Nations has given the Israeli military the GPS coordinates and precise location of all of its facilities across Gaza Strip to the military. And if the military is directly shooting at these schools because it believes that there is fire coming from it, then you can also say that the Israeli military is deliberately targeting civilians. It may not be targeting civilians exclusively, but it's certainly targeting civilians as well as the fighters or whoever it may allege to be in the vicinity. So either way you look at it, the Israeli military in one of these two instances is contradicting itself with its actions on the ground. But the more important point to keep in mind, and this is a point that is, you know, being said time and time again, the Israeli military, without a doubt, has unleashed this war across the entire Gaza Strip. No inch of Gaza has been immune. And what has made this war unprecedented is that in most conflicts, in most wars, people at least have the ability to flee the area. This is one of the first wars, if not the only war in the history of man, where the entire battle zone or the entire war was in a confined area, fenced in, and the people have nowhere to flee. And I think that by its very definition, as many people are now describing it, a form of collective punishment. What is a Hamas target? And in fact, the particular incident at the UN school, and if I can just cite this example, when the incident at the Jabalia refugee camp happened at the United Nations school, the Al-Fakhura school, where more than 40 people were killed, the Israeli military immediately came out saying that it was fired upon from the school or from the area of the school, and that's why they had to shell the area. But by the United Nations' own admissions, by the spokesperson of the United Nations, Christopher Gunness, he was informed, or at least according to the United Nations, they were informed that indeed that was incorrect. The Israeli military acknowledged no firing had come from the vicinity of the school, despite the fact that the Israeli military had shelled the school, killing more than 40 people. So I think the reality on the ground speaks for itself, and that indeed civilians in Gaza, whether they are directly or indirectly the target of the Israeli military, they are indeed the casualties as a result of the Israeli military.
Ayman, let's go ahead and take our first caller. Go ahead, caller.
I think we're going to be a little bit delayed on our first caller, but we'd like to take our first caller now. Caller, you're up. Oh, looks like we've lost our first caller. We might have another one on the line. Caller, go ahead with your question.
Well, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. We've been hearing little snippets of the use of chemical weapons against the people of Gaza, like white phosphorus and depleted uranium, and a new bomb developed by the Air Force, the U.S. Air Force, in 2006 called DIME, which is dense intermetal explosives, which gets into people's under people's skin and causes the same damage like shrapnel would, only you can't see it. And can you please address that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Let me first start off by saying I am not in any way a warfare expert. I don't have any military background. I've never served in any armed forces, and I don't have any technical experience in munitions. So let me get that clear out of the way. Mm-hmm. What I can say is the following. I have seen munitions that are consistent with white phosphorus dropped in the heart of Gaza. And it's important to remember one thing. White phosphorus in and of itself is not an illegal weapon, but using it against the civilian population is illegal or under international humanitarian law. And what I have seen, and I stood on that roof inside Gaza City for several days, for weeks, you can see so much of the northern part of Gaza Strip. You can see where these munitions that are believed to be white phosphorus dropping on civilian populations. Now, here's the evidence that people have, a few things. One, we went to the burn unit at the Shifa Hospital, the main medical complex here. The doctors there all said that these people are suffering from burns consistent with white phosphorus. And it's important to remember white phosphorus is a very incendiary component or element that really burns the skin deep and across large parts of the body and really ignites everything it comes in contact with on fire. So the doctors there assess that and say it is consistent with white phosphorus. They can't say absolutely, because at the end of the day, to determine something white phosphorus requires some chemical analysis, which the technology here, they simply don't have. That's the first thing. But secondly, there's no doubt that even according to technical experts who have operated here, human rights activists who are on the Israeli side of the border, not in the Gaza side, on the Israeli side of the border, saw the munitions being dropped on people, described it as white phosphorus. So again, you have not just the opinion of independent journalists, but you also have the opinion or the experience and expertise of human rights activists and technical experts or military experts, including the United Nations Director of Operations in Gaza City, who was inside the UN compound when white phosphorus shells were dropped on the United Nations compound and set, paradoxically, the entire warehouse up in flames, a warehouse full of supplies for the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. In terms of the other two elements that you were talking about, the explosives, Norwegian doctors that were operating in Gaza City, particularly two doctors, and I apologize for forgetting, one's name is Mads Gilbert and the other, I believe, is Eric Fosse. Or I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that, but those two Norwegian doctors were here in the early days of the war. According to Dr. Mads Gilbert, he described the wounds sustained by so many of the Palestinians, and that led him to conclude that new munitions were being dropped or being used in this particular war, those consistent with what they call dimes, those types of explosives that the caller was referring to, explosives that have a very dense explosive component to them, if you will. And he described that. He's spoken about that openly in Gaza, but he's also spoken about that openly in Norway now that he has returned. And prior to that, there is evidence to suggest the Israeli military has used these types of explosives. Prior to that, in 2006, in the Lebanon-Israel war in the south of Lebanon, and again in Gaza in previous instances. So there is certainly a lot of international attention to the munitions that were dropped, and many, many people away from journalists have come out and said Israel has indeed used weapons against international law because they were used against the civilian population. That has violated international humanitarian law, and this is what many have described as war crimes.
Before we take our next caller, let me say that you're listening to One Land, Many Voices with Hala Goris and William Seaman, and you're tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM at the Columbia Gorge. Also available as streaming audio at KBOO's website, www.kboo.fm. Go ahead, caller.
Our next caller should be ready.
Okay, I'm ready.
Go ahead.
I find this discussion kind of one-sided, and it disturbs me that the group of people you have together, they're also quick to totally disdain the Israelis, who are really reacting to civilian population attacks by Hamas. So can we talk a little bit about that and how, if all Hamas had to do to prevent this war was stop firing into Israel. Could we have some discussion of that? I would appreciate it.
Thank you very much, caller.
So, Ayman, did you hear our caller talk about his concern that this is very much a one-sided discussion happening here? And can you address the Israeli explanation that they attacked Gaza in order to stop the rockets being fired from Hamas?
Sure, absolutely. There's no doubt that over the past 8 years, since rockets started landing on southern Israel, particularly the towns of Sderot and elsewhere, now slightly even further, that the people of southern Israel have been living under what they call terror and fear. There's no doubt about that. And the Israeli military objective was to stop the rocket fire to provide protection for the civilian population there. And there has been very strong international condemnation of the tactic used by Hamas's military wing and other Palestinian factions, that also being described as a war crime because it in those weapons per se, it's very indiscriminatory is what I should say. There's no precise targeting. In fact, it's aimed specifically at a civilian population. So certainly that has drawn very strong international condemnation. So there's no doubt about that. The point, I think, and this is what I was saying earlier about how important it is to contextualize this story. The listener raised a very good point that they've been living, the Israeli people have been living under this, blanket of terror, if you will, for several years, for 8 years. But here's where it's important to have context. The Palestinian factions that are firing rockets are not firing rockets because they're trying to kill as many civilians as possible simply for the sake of killing civilians. There is, under international law, the concept of initial aggressor, meaning that you cannot claim self-defense when you in yourself are viewed as the person who is aggressing someone else or committing an aggression against someone else. Under international law, and if there's anything that's objective that we can use, under international law, the people in Gaza are living under a military occupation, not for 8 years that they've been firing rockets, not for 15 years since they started the Oslo peace process in 1993. They've been living under military occupation for 41 years. So under international law, Israel is considered the initial aggressor in this occupation. By definition, by legal definition, the state of Israel cannot claim the right of self-defense. Now, this isn't my assessment. This is the assessment of international legal scholars. There is no doubt that Israel has a right to self-defense. But when it's self-defense, as an initial aggressor, the concept negates it. It simply can't be that Israel, this is what people, legal scholars will say to you. If there is indeed an end to the occupation, if there is indeed a Palestinian sovereign state that delegitimizes the right to resistance, then Israel can claim its right to self-defense against the Palestinian factions that are firing rockets into southern Israel. But so long as Palestinians live under Israel military occupation, in the eyes of the international legal community, under international law, the Israelis will be perceived as the initial aggressors. Any Palestinian action will be seen as resistance to that occupation. And even though Palestinians or the international community has deemed that act as terror, and has deemed that act as illegal and as a possible war crime that it is targeting Israeli civilians, there is no doubt in the eyes also of the international legal community that it's very difficult to achieve any kind of solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict through military means alone. And again, it's important to keep in mind, you must always keep this conflict in the proper context over decades, not over 22 days that this war began, not over 8 years that Palestinians have been firing rockets at Israel, but by the same time Israel has engaged in military activity against the Palestinians, and not also in the 18 months that Israel has imposed a complete siege on the people of Gaza, turning it into what has been described as the world's largest open-air prison. And that's the point that I think we need to keep in mind, that always rounds out this discussion, puts it in the proper context for everyone who's trying to understand why it is that we are in the situation that we are in.
If you joined us late, I want to let you know that we have with us Ayman Muhyildeen, who is the Gaza correspondent for Al Jazeera English, the international English-speaking news channel of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera network. Before we take our next caller, I want to thank our callers for being patient and holding on. Before we take our next caller, the last caller who criticized what he called the lack of balance in how we are dealing with today's program would probably follow up to say to you, Ayman, but the Israelis pulled out in 2005. And so why didn't the rockets stop then? Can you address that, please?
The concept that Israel pulled out in 2005 is perhaps the biggest misconception that prevails in particularly the Western media. And there's two reasons for this. One,
Israel withdrew or redeployed its soldiers from inside Gaza to the borders of Gaza, and they withdrew their illegal settlers. Again, under international law, these were illegal settlers because Israel was trying to transfer a civilian population from its country into an occupied territory to alter the demographic balance that existed there, and that is illegal under international law. But Israel withdrew its illegal settlers and its troops, but Israel did not end its occupation of Gaza. And what I mean by that, in 2005, the Israeli military pulled out, but Israel controlled all the crossing points from Gaza into southern Israel. It controlled the territorial waters off of the coast of Gaza. It controlled the airspace that belonged to Gaza. It controlled the civilian registry, the population registry of the people of Gaza. And it, through a framework agreement, controlled the border crossing between Egypt and Gaza, which means that even though Israel doesn't share that border between Egypt and Gaza, it still exercised control over who can leave and who cannot leave through the agreement. So what you've really done is, instead of keeping the guards that guard the prison inside the compound, you've essentially moved the prison guards to the four corners of the prison, but you still control the population inside that prison. That's the analogy that is often made when people talk about 2005 being the end of Israel's occupation. Palestinian fishermen are not able to fish off of their territorial waters under internationally recognized water, like they can do in Israel, like they can do in Egypt. You cannot fly into Gaza because Israel controls the airspace. If you are a cell phone company and you wanted a frequency to operate a company in Gaza, a cell phone company, you have to get that frequency from the Israeli military, from the Israeli government. They have to give that to you. So while Israel has withdrawn its military, withdrawn its illegal settlers to the border, by no means has it stopped controlling the life of Palestinians. And again, when I say that they control the civilian defense, I'm sorry, the civilian registry, that means if you were born in Gaza, you had to get your ID okayed by the Israeli government, saying that you are registered, that you were born in Gaza, and the Israeli government was then the one that would issue you a specific number and authenticate you, if you will, as a Palestinian. That was not done by a sovereign Palestinian government. At the end of the day, to be free means to be a sovereign government, and that's what you never had in 2005 when Israel withdrew.
And we do have a couple callers on the line, so let's go to our next caller, please.
Yes, good morning. I want to thank both of you for having this show today and this this guest who's really helping to clarify a lot of important information. This may be a question you want to answer when your guest isn't on the show anymore, but I was wondering, this is really for you, Hala. Did Jeff Merkley really return your campaign donation? I've heard different stories about it, and I thought, well, I might as well just ask you. And I was just wondering if you could give some context to that. So
sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'll address that in a different program. We actually
okay.
did have a program, and we will you can go to it to review that program. Yes, he did return my campaign contribution of $2,300 for calling Israel's actions in 2006 against Lebanon and against Gaza as terrorist actions.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying that, and I'll look up the program then.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Before we go to our next caller, I do have to make a few announcements here. At 9 a.m. on the Old Mole, this is all on KABU this morning, coming up on KABU. At 9 a.m., the Old Mole reflects on the last day of the nightmare and the high hopes and great anxieties surrounding the Obama administration. And the movie Moles look back at an earlier nightmare as they review the film Frost Nixon. At 10 a.m. this morning, hear a preview of the 24th annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Keep Alive the Dream. Also, Eugen Rashad speaks with local people who are in Washington for the inauguration of Barack Obama as president. They'll talk about the meaning of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday in light of the inauguration. And at 11, we begin live all-day coverage of the 24th annual Keep Alive the Dream tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., an event featuring music, dance, psalm, inspirational speaking, and politically motivating speeches. And now we go to our next caller for our guest. Caller, go ahead, please.
Good morning, William. Hello, Hala. Thank you.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. Some new numbers and about the devastation, and a question for your important guest. apparently there have been at least 1,300 deaths and about $1.4 billion of devastation, according to today's Financial Times. 4,100 houses were utterly destroyed, 17,000 more damaged. The 25 education and health buildings have been destroyed, and 20 mosques have been destroyed. Now, the United Nations has said that 53 of its buildings, most of them schools, were either damaged or destroyed. About $1.4 billion they tally up. The question is this. Syria and Saudi Arabia recently, just in the last several days, have indicated that they are going to set up a fund for the rebuilding of Gaza. My question is, Syria and Saudi Arabia, as well as Egypt, have simply stood idly by and been part of this whole horror, which is the prison colony called Gaza. And to what extent will their promises of a $1 billion fund come true? And to what extent can they be can the blame be shared for this $1.4 billion devastation plus lives and the horror that we've seen? Thank you.
Well, that's an excellent question. In fact, it is one of the most important things that you get a sense of when you talk to the Palestinian people here in Gaza. When you go out and about and talk to them and see the anger on their faces, the frustration, they will always ask, where were the Arab regimes? Where are the Arab governments? Why are they not helping? Why are they not using the influence that they have, the power that they have, their close relationships with the U.S. really, to put an end to this aggression as they saw it? They know at the end of the day that the Arab street is with the Palestinian people. That was very evident from the hundreds of thousands of people who took to protest, not just in the Arab world, but across Europe and even in the United States. But at the end of the day, it's why didn't the Arab regimes do more? And it's important, obviously, to keep in mind these are not democratically elected governments, according to many people's professional assessments. So they don't reflect the accurate will of the Palestinian people, or actually they don't accurately reflect the will of their respective governments. The funds that are trying to be set up to pay the reconstruction are also part of something that we should keep in mind, a larger political game taking place in the region where you now clearly have two different camps emerge in the Middle East, camps that obviously compete with one another for influence and compete with one another for support, those that seek support from the United States, and those that seek support from elsewhere in the world, including Iran. And those sources of competition trickle down all the way to Gaza and who will fund and reconstruct the Gaza Strip. So it's important to put that in that context and not lose sight of how the regional politics and the regional forces are also at play in who reconstructs Gaza. But there's also something very important to keep in mind for your listener, and that is, or your caller, and that is, we have been here before, and that is a couple of years ago, the Israeli military, when it had deemed Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority, which now it does business with, as the enemy of the state, they bombed the Gaza Strip repeatedly, and it lasted for several years and destroyed pretty much the entire infrastructure of Gaza, just as it has done over the 22 days. Back then, the European Union came in and footed the bill, and so too did the World Bank, and so too did other projects. And yet here we are again, you know, several years later, with those very same projects that the European Union funded and the World Bank funded completely decimated, and now it's going to be up to the international community to fund once again. In fact, we've already heard from the European Union commissioner who deals with the development, and they have expressed their grave reservations about having to foot the bill for Israel's military operations once again. It seems that every couple of years, the Israeli military will engage in massive military campaign against the Palestinian people, either in the West Bank or Gaza, and then it's up to the international community to come and foot the bill. So it's very frustrating for these European Union countries, at least as the way they describe it. And that is also what has prompted many Arab countries to probably try to chip in and try to foot the bill, because there is no doubt, according to Palestinian people here and elsewhere, that their inability to stop this aggression has certainly led them to feel that, well, they can pay the price for the reconstruction. And that is a sense that many here believe is why they're jumping to now try to fund the reconstruction efforts, because they couldn't stop the war. They seemed very impotent, if you will. And now, because of that guilty feeling of the impotence they had in not stopping the war, using their influence, particularly Saudi Arabia and Egypt, who have very good relations with America, and particularly Egypt, which also enjoys close relations with Israel, one of the two Arab countries that has an official peace treaty with Israel, that they were impotent in stopping this war. So they want to try to foot the bill in the reconstruction efforts as a way to save face with their domestic Arab constituents.
Ayman, we have a couple people on the phone lines, but I want to give you a chance to tell our listeners, how can they hear and see your reports on Al Jazeera English? You know, we can't get it on our cable here. It's very difficult to get. But I know you provide streaming on YouTube. Can you describe how our listeners can see and hear you from Gaza?
Sure. There's several ways. One, Al Jazeera English has partnered up with YouTube. There is an Al Jazeera branded channel with YouTube that broadcasts all of our news bulletins, exclusive reports, packages, live guest shows, segments. That is through YouTube. Just by accessing YouTube, typing in Al Jazeera, and then looking at the actual channel options. You can also obviously search by name, the names of individual correspondents for Al Jazeera, the names of specific programs. If someone follows it and they like a particular program, they can also search previous shows and stuff. Al Jazeera English's website, which is aljazeera.net/English, has live streaming on the web 24 hours, 7 days a week, so you can watch it there, I believe in low resolution. But at the same time, there are three different options whereby viewers online can join a subscription service and get it in full high-quality value, again, streaming 24 hours live on the Internet. And I believe it's Jump TV, Live Station, and one more, I'm not sure in the name, I apologize. But those are all linked at the website if you go to aljazeera.net/English.
Let's go ahead and take one more caller. Go ahead, caller.
Is that me?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, hello. My love to everyone. I am an old woman, and I want to cry instead of talk, but here's what I believe. I believe this country should not be doing an inauguration tomorrow while this horror is going on in Gaza. I feel very bad what my country is doing to your people. Namaste.
Thank you, caller. Do we have another caller online? Let's go to our next caller there.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, go ahead.
I want to thank you for being on the air. And what I've got to say is it just me, or do I see a lot of similarities between the Warsaw Ghetto during World War II and what's going on in Gaza now? I would like to ask all my Jewish friends and Israeli friends to look back at history, see what you guys came from. Are we going to have to start having Holocaust museums for what the poor people in Gaza are going through? I'll listen to your comment on the air. God bless. Thank you.
Any comment, Ayman?
Well, it's certainly, I think many academics and scholars and pundits have written about that very same subject, that, in following... the tragedy of the Holocaust, and many, Jewish scholars and Israeli scholars have written about this, that, the birth of Israel in the shadows of the Holocaust obviously gave it a lot of legitimacy. But the occupation of the Palestinian people and displacement and dispossession of the Palestinian people is not justifiable. And that is really the most important thing. At the end of the day, as much as the world and the international community, and particularly the West, wants to provide Israel with security, and because it's in their own interests and because it is in the moral conscience of the Western world, then so too are the Palestinian people. They have the right to security, to peace, to live in harmony on their land and not be dispossessed from it. At the end of the day, there's really several competing ideologies, and many scholars have written about this. In fact, there's some who even argue that really the end of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict begins with inside Israel itself. What does the Israeli public want from the Palestinian people? What does it want from the Palestinian land? The criticism has been, that for 60 years, the Zionist project has continued unabated. And there are some now that are saying this simple, continued expansion of land at the expense of another dispossessed people is no longer tolerable. It simply is inexcusable. And the violations to human rights that are taking place so blatantly now to the international community cannot be dismissed simply as under the blanket of Israel's security, or under the blanket of anti-Semitism, or under the blanket of Israel is the only democracy in a sea of hostile countries. And I think more and more people write about that. I think more and more people speak about that openly inside Israel. And sometimes the debate inside Israel is much more rigorous and critical than it is in the West particularly. And that has what frustrated many people.
Yes, of course.
America obviously has a lot of influence on Israel.
Yes, we want to thank our special guest, Ayman Muhyildeen, who is the Gaza correspondent for Al Jazeera English. Thank you for joining One Land, Many Voices.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
And we'll hopefully be talking with you again sometime soon. And we'd like to thank all our listeners and all our callers this morning. This has been a special broadcast of One Land, Many Voices. This Friday at 9 a.m., One Land, Many Voices will return to the airwaves with another special feature on Gaza and on the work that we're doing here in Portland, Oregon, our local work responding to this crisis. Thank you for listening to One Land, Many Voices.